There are so many things I do every day that I barely think twice about. Grabbing a coffee with my team this morning, going for a hike on the weekend, seeing friends, getting to work, just being out in the world. Honestly, it's a cliche, but they're the sorts of things that make life worth living. And for some people on the NDIS, these everyday moments fall into the category of social and community participation. It's a pretty clinical term for programs that help people stay connected, build confidence and independence, and avoid isolation. Now, with major changes planned for the NDIS, the future of funding for these social activities is uncertain. And a new government report says some groups are expected to be hit harder than others. You're about to hear a bit more detail on that, but if this is something you're navigating right now, I'd love to know what it means for you. How would these changes affect your day-to-day life? Here with me is Dr. Katie Butler, a lecturer in human services at the University of Newcastle. She's also blind and an NDIS participant. Katie, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do these social and community supports mean for your day-to-day life?
Well, they are pretty fundamental because these social and community participation supports enable me to do things that I can't do on my own or that are unreasonably difficult for me to do on my own. So we're talking the things like going for a hike, like you mentioned before, getting out to things like park run, even doing really difficult shopping trips like Bunnings. Imagine trying to do that without being able to see. And the important thing to note is that these supports look different for different groups of people. Some people rely on these supports to get them to things like doctor's appointments and other really important things, even getting to work. So anything that we do outside of the home, that is what these supports help us to do.
So you have a seeing eye dog who's with you day to day, and this is the sorts of things that would allow you to navigate environments that are unfamiliar to you and your dog.
Yeah, that's right. A dog fulfills one function, which is the immediate mobility need. So she helps me get around obstacles. She can target things in the environment. She can indicate when I'm at a curb. But she unfortunately can't, you know, help me find things in unfamiliar places, you know, in that shopping context that I was talking about before. She unfortunately can't drive either. So, you know, I'm still waiting for those robotic cars to get even more specialised that you were mentioning in the intro.
Yeah, and also spying on you as you're driving around. Katie, if you lose, part of the difficulty with this conversation is a lot of it's still unknown, but if you lost funding to these programs, what would it mean for you?
So I started receiving NDIS funding when I was a young adult, and I found that these social and community participation funding, it supported me to figure out who I was and, you know, get out into the world and discover the hobbies that I liked doing and really formed who I am now as a person. And to think about losing that is pretty sad, because I think it would increase my dependency on family again. It would mean that I'd lose the ability to have some spontaneity in my life and do activities that people take for granted. And I think these kind of impacts will be similarly reflected across the community, but for some people it will have even more significant impacts in terms of affecting their ability to participate in the economic environment, you know, going to work and having, you know, personal care at work that they need, you know, to be there and to get through the day.
For some, the government's done some analysis of which participants would be hardest hit by these proposed cuts. People with visual impairments were one of the groups that were singled out there. How does that land with you?
It was such a nasty shock. There have been so many things that have hit really hard over the last few weeks, and this one was just unexpected to me, but it makes sense because the government have decided that as a blanket rule, they're going to reduce the social and community participation funding. But there isn't any sort of a sort of breaking down of who accesses that support more than other people. So blind people and people with low vision, their NDIS plans are significantly made up of these particular supports because they are the things we need above other things. And it just depends on the kind of disability you have that it dictates the kind of support that you need. So this is going to create inequities because some disability groups will be hit harder than others simply because of the nature of the support that we require.
I should say a government spokesperson said the 50% reduction on social budgets in addition to a 10% cut for daily activities to build a person's capacity was necessary to return funding to 2023 levels, and that these cuts would not result in a reduction for all because most participants do not use their full budget allocations for these programs. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice you've been hearing is that of Dr. Katie Butler. She's a lecturer in human services at the University of Newcastle. She's also an NDIS participant. She's blind. And we're talking about how proposed changes to the NDIS, especially the parts that fall into social and community participation, might impact you. If you have a story of how you're trying to navigate this, I'd love to hear it. One person says the cuts to social and community participation is a retrograde move that makes many disabled people likely to suffer from isolation and even lack of support for daily activities such as shopping or attending medical appointments. As a visually impaired NDIS participant in regional Australia, the NDIS helps to overcome the services gap due to failure of state and local government to provide the basics of safe mobility in our towns. No footpaths, very poor, if any, public transport, buses without wheelchair access. I can be independent with good mobility support. Without good mobility, I'm isolated and I'm lucky if I can get out of the house once a week. That's one person's experience there. Katie, it's interesting in that text, it's sort of like the NDIS is overcoming other shortcomings in our environments that maybe if we had those, we wouldn't need to rely so heavily on the NDIS, at least in that person's situation.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And I can certainly relate to that personally because sometimes I have to use a support worker to help me access activities that would otherwise be inaccessible. For example, group fitness activities. I can't see what's going on at the front of the room. So, you know, to have that support to help try and figure out what to do, it's still a big challenge to do that. And there's, yeah, lots of other activities that fall similarly within that kind of category. And our communities do need to be doing more to make things more accessible and inclusive so that people don't have to rely on these sorts of supports as much. That would be ideal.
Yeah. Also here with me is Megan Spindler-Smith, who's the acting CEO of People with a Disability Australia, which is the peak rights and advocacy organisation. Megan, when you're looking at this analysis of who's going to feel the impact of these changes, what stood out to you?
Thanks. Look, I think the biggest thing is the fact that this is the government's own analysis. And what it's actually showing is that it's going to impact people with more non-apparent or disabilities that actually require a type of support that not everyone fully understands. It seems like people understand the need for a mobility aid or access to tools, physical tools that can support us. But a lot of the time, the community doesn't understand why we might need someone to help us navigate environments that are unusual, unexpected, just like Katie talked about, but also around the fact that we may need it to support us to even engage in employment. And what the report actually says is that participants with visual impairment allocate around 34% of their plans to these supports, and participants with psychosocial disability around 30%. And then for those with Down syndrome, it's around 28%. So these are not small numbers that it's going to impact, and they're definitely not extras. And I think, sadly, at the moment, a lot of the conversation is, well, these are just extras. We're just cutting those extras. But actually, what we're doing by cutting these is removing that important and significant support so we can just access community like everyone else.
So, Megan, when I said before that the statement that I said before from the spokesperson pointed out this idea that most participants don't use their full budget allocations for these programs. They're trying to get the funding back to 2023 levels. If those allocations aren't being used, is it fair enough that they're pulling back?
The thing is that social and community participation supports actually sits in a wider bucket of core supports. And so what the clarity we would need is to understand how much of that is actually coming from the social and community aspect versus other forms of core supports. And so we'd need clarity on that. But what we do know is currently around 393,000, like 100,000 NDIS participants currently receive funding for this. And what that shows is that approximately 60,000 NDIS participants are expected to lose at least half their funding specifically for social and community participation, and that's just in this first phase. So if it's truly being underspent, that's fine, but it's not actually clear that it's coming from that particular space that's the underspent.
So some of the wording in this government analysis said the decision to reduce this budget was preferred over others because it does not impact the health and safety of participants. Megan, what do you say to that?
It's absolutely opposite. First of all, it removes the concept that safety is more than just medical safety. It's more than just making sure that we can access the kind of medications we need. This is actually about making sure that there is not over-reliance on informal supports that then have a high likelihood of meaning we can't go into the community. And the Disability Royal Commission demonstrated that when people with disability are unable to access their community, access the safety of that, then actually those safeguards of external parties, the community that they're engaging with, being able to see if there's not just physical safety, emotional safety, those things are going to be met. But also, let's be really clear, this is how many people get to their medical appointments. So if you can't get to your medical appointment, your health will go down. If you can't engage in an ordinary life and actually go to work or have choices that are not segregated and be able to actually build your skills, then your health does go down. So it's a really opposite concept if that's the touting that it's not going to impact that, because it's going to impact everything from maintaining employment to being able to undertake training to being actually able to do sport and community activities. And we know all of those things have high both safety and health aspects to them.
You're telling me your thoughts. One person says social and community participation is life-changing. It's not a nice to have. Another says it's very problematic. Everyone gets upset if the government reforms tax needed to pay for services, but everyone wants more services like the NDIS. Isha is telling their story, saying, I just turned 70, I'm about to retire, and I'm the sole parent of a young man with intellectual and physical disability, including being non-verbal. Isha says, I was feeling that when I die, he will be okay, but now I'm very concerned. Managing his physical and emotional needs so he can have a good life will fall back to me if he has less support in the community and building his social and other skills. And when I'm not here, what will life be like for him? Megan, this is affecting whole families.
This is affecting more than just the individual person with disability. And that's the thing, is that people are forgetting that the support needs, the access needs don't go away. They just get transferred. So they either get transferred to informal supports, like people's families, like parents, even to people's children. So they get transferred to those things. And then, or those people, apologies, and then Where do those people actually be able to find the time or space? That means that sometimes they have to choose not to participate in employment or the community themselves because this becomes their full-time job. This is not about just one set of individuals. It actually impacts a whole family and a whole community as well.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about those knock-on economic effects, as you say there, Megan. Katie, one of the big factors playing out at the moment is uncertainty. No one knows what's going to happen. How does that feel for you?
Yeah, it's really scary. And it also affects the way you start to think about the future as well. And I just want to echo what Megan was saying about safety, because thinking about your future and what's ahead is also impacted by this in that regard, because if you start to lose control of how your life looks and the agency that you have, that is really problematic. People actually do not survive when they start to be withdrawn from community. We've seen instances of this occur in the disability community. And people said, how did nobody know that that person was in trouble? And that's because they weren't out and about being seen and having people looking out for them. That's what we risk with these changes.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Dr. Katie Butler from the University of Newcastle, an NDIS participant herself, and Megan Spindler-Smith, who's the acting CEO of People with Disability Australia, talking about proposed changes to the NDIS that will make it harder for some people to access social and community activities. You're telling me your experiences with this. One says budget allocations are not always used in regions because support services are hard to find. Another here from a nurse who works across hospital and community settings. They say, I ask NDIS participants to take a step back and ask themselves what they really need rather than to keep taking what they've come to expect to be provided for them as a lovely luxury. There are so many cases where I see disability people are living a privileged circumstance at the expense of our NDIS system. Megan, do you want to respond to that?
Look, if that's what they're seeing, that is extremely unusual, because that is not even remotely the case. People with disability are much more likely to be in socioeconomic distress in spaces where they're not being able to access what they need, or being able to ensure that they can have the basic rights that everyone else gets, like being able to access employment, like being able to have safe housing that doesn't require being in segregated spaces, which the Disability Royal Commission demonstrated that the minute you segregate, the minute you create spaces only for people with disability, you actually increase reductions in health, you increase lack of safety. And so I would be really concerned with that narrative, because the reality is not that. And I guess the question is, what is privilege when you're talking about these sort of spaces? Is it privilege that you get to go to work, engage in the community, actually be able to go see a movie or listen to some form of show? Like, those things are things that everyone else can access. Those things are not being, the actual basis of not being paid for in the NDIS. It's the supports that you get to go there that are being covered there, because we can't access those spaces because they are not accessible without support. And that's the key. So I wouldn't call that privilege, and it's a really problematic narrative.
Absolutely. But I think the government has sort of said it's in a hard position. Without significant budget, the whole system is in danger. Reform is needed.
Look, we don't disagree that there needs to be reform, and there needs to be fixing of the broken parts of the system. But also, these changes are going to be directly at people with disability, rather than fixing some of the problematic decision-making processes and the underlying issues within the agency or how things are being done. Those things need to be fixed, and they will show a difference. But taking just directly is just a big swipe, and all it will do is put pressure onto other systems. That's including the hospital system, including the out-of-home care system, because people are going to not have a choice but engage in other places. So it's fine if we want to cut it from the NDIS, but be prepared. We're going to see increases, and we're going to see increased harm and increased risk of death. And this is the thing, I don't say that lightly. I'm not someone who says these things lightly, but that is what's going to happen. And as somebody myself who doesn't necessarily have the level of supports I know I currently need, one of the things that I have to make a decision about is, do I do my job or do I have an actual life? And right now I'm working but I don't have a social life. I don't go out into the community because I can't do both without support. And that in itself is a choice many people with disability are currently having to make.
Katie, you're also inside this system. You're studying this at an academic level as well. What's the approach here that you'd recommend?
It is really frustrating to see the cuts being applied to participant plans when I would argue that there's actually savings to be made at many different levels in the scheme itself. So we see, as participants, lots of ways that money is wasted or applied, you know, incorrectly. For example, participants have to pay for really expensive reports to justify pieces of equipment. For example, in front of me right now, I have some palm cards with Braille written on them. I used my Perkins Brailler this morning to type up some notes so I'd remember what to say today. That Perkins Brailler, I didn't claim because I would have had to have gotten a report from an occupational therapist to advise that this piece of equipment, which is a very basic piece of equipment, is necessary. And it also overrides the fact that I have expertise about what I need in my life. So we have instances of that occurring. We also have the NDIA fighting participants in legal battles that they rarely win, the NDIA rarely win, that is, and wasting millions on those appeals.
Megan, Katie, thank you both so much for joining me today. Dr. Katie Butler is a lecturer in human services at the University of Newcastle and an NDIS participant. Megan Spindler-Smith is acting CEO of People with Disability Australia.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.